when the coup was happening in Haiti, I kept thinking, now wait a second. I mean, you know, didn't this just happen in 2002? I mean, how could people actually be believing this when it was already disproven the last time around, right, that Chavez had not willingly left the country? And when it happened to Chavez, I was thinking, boy, doesn't anybody remember Chile when the newspapers all were blaring, Salvador Allende commits suicide? I don't know how many of you are old enough to remember that that's what the newspapers said the first few days. I think that in terms of Cuba, anybody, how many of you have either been to Cuba or read substantially about Cuba? I think anybody who knows about Cuba doesn't need to be told that there is an awful lot of disinformation and spin about Cuba. So I'm not going to spend most of my time talking about the giving examples to prove that case. More that I think we need to look at three things. One is why, both in the broad sense and about Cuba, why is there so much disinformation about Cuba? How it takes place, give you some examples, and then the important question, what can we do about it? The why, obviously, it's not just that the people who run the world media, which is mostly the United States and the major corporations based in the United States, why do they do this? Is they just don't like Cuba? Obviously not. We're talking about issues of sovereignty. We're talking about a country and its satellites around the globe, including Canada, that simply do not want to allow third world countries, and especially Latin America, which they consider to be their own backyard, to enjoy independence and sovereignty when it might affect the business interests, the pocketbooks of those corporations. They especially don't want Cuba setting an example for others. A Cuban-American friend in Florida once said to me, you know, they view Cuba the way people see crabgrass in their backyard. The idea of letting people go and see for themselves, see that and come back to, in my case, the United States and say, wait a minute, why aren't we doing that here? Or in other, especially for other third world countries, to be able to read about, to hear about, to see what's going on in Cuba and say, but that is, you know, the new slogan of today, a better world is possible. Well, Cuba has been showing that in so many ways for a long time, and that is dangerous. And so we have this media spin, but it's much bigger than that. I think everybody who's here knows it's bigger than that. In the United States, we talked about the Vietnam syndrome. The Vietnam syndrome was the right wing of the United States trying to figure out why we lost that war, right? You know, why did we lose that war? Because from their viewpoint, of course, the Vietnamese people gaining their independence and sovereignty was a loss. And the conclusion that they reached, one of the major conclusions, was that we lost it because of the media, right? This was the first war that was covered by television. Television was fledgling in the 50s and still hitting its stride in the 60s, and no war had really been covered by television before, or as massively because of better transportation by the print media. And so you had all this media that was showing the American public, one, that what the Pentagon and the White House was handing out wasn't necessarily true. We weren't winning. We were losing a lot of people. People were dying. People were coming back in bodies. Bags. And it was creating a sense, we don't want to be in this war, right? Maybe there are things wrong with this war, or just that too many young men were dying. Many people, not all, but many people of those who felt that that the United States should have won the war in Vietnam blamed the media. And one of the things that they said, and it was in print media at the time, a little obscure, not everybody would have read it, but was, you never again let the media into your war. And they put that into practice. They put it into practice in Grenada. Grenada was the first time that the United States went to war and simply excluded the press. The press were not allowed onto the island of Grenada. If they wanted to cover the U.S. invasion of Grenada in 1983, they had to take the footage that the U.S. military was shooting, filming, and giving to them selectively. And Cuba at that time opened its doors. I was in Cuba as a journalist at that time, and it opened its doors to all the American press who wanted, you know, to be covering Grenada, and they couldn't get Grenada, so they took the next best. They went to Cuba. And for the first couple of days, they were doing a good job. They were sending back images of these 40-ish pot-bellied construction workers who had been portrayed in the U.S. media as this military force of Cubans in Grenada who had been there to help them construct an airport runway to promote international tourism in Grenada, and giving the, you know, the Cuban side of it, and therefore somewhat of the Grenadian side of it. And after 2 days, the journalists were all hanging around the bar in the Hotel Riviera and telling us that their producers would not let them send any more feeds, and their editors would not let them send any more feeds, because people were so outraged at this portrayal that was different from the conventional wisdom that they wanted to believe, that the U.S. were good guys going into Grenada for good reasons. That was the first time that the U.S. media backed down on what they had up until then considered the sacrosanct First Amendment, right? That the media is the fifth estate. The media has all these rights and privileges and prerogatives, and nobody can silence the media. We have the right to go anywhere. And they buckled under without a protest, without a whimper. They simply let Ronald Reagan tell them that they could not go in and cover a war that the United States was engaged in. We saw that extended in the first Persian Gulf War, the first war against Iraq. We saw it refined with, again, pools. Then you could have media pools go in. Selected media could go in and give whatever they thought was important to film or interview to the rest of the media. And then you had embedded media for the last one, going in and sleeping with the media, essentially. What does all this have to do with Cuba? Well, I usually, when I talk about disinformation with Cuba, and I'm going to do it to you anyway, even though you can pick up a handout of this, I usually start with a joke, with the Pope joke, unless a lot of you have all heard the Pope joke. Cubans love to make fun of themselves. Cubans have a lot of sense of humor, and they deal with a lot of things through jokes. When the Pope visited Cuba, of course, there were a million jokes that all had to do with the Pope. Most of them are not translatable because they function on the basis of the fact that the word for Pope in Spanish is the same as the word for potato. And so you can just imagine all the jokes that came out of that. But this one, the story goes that Fidel Castro and Pope John Paul were walking along Havana's famous seaside wall, the Malecón, when a gust of wind came and blew the Pope's mitre, that conical hat, off of his head and into the water. And Fidel, the ever-gracious host, immediately jumped over the wall and into the water to go out. He was going to swim out and retrieve the Pope's mitre. But lo and behold, instead of, you know, sinking into the water and swimming, Fidel found himself walking along the surface of the water. Surprise, but he shrugs, goes out, picks up the mitre, walks back, hops back over the wall, gives the mitre to the Pope, and they continue their stroll along the Malecón. Well, this is major news. So the next day, there were prominent headlines in the Cuban daily newspaper, the Granma, proclaiming, "Fidel performs revolutionary feat, walks on water to retrieve Pope's mitre." Well, the Vatican's L'Osservatore also considered this a big event. They also had banner headlines. Their version said, "Pope performs miracle, enables Fidel to walk on water." Well, you can't expect the Miami papers to stay far behind and all that. They banner headlined it too. "Proven beyond a doubt, Fidel cannot swim." And everybody laughs at that, and I wish it were more laughable. If you've ever followed the Miami Herald and seen the kind of spin that they are able to put on almost everything, and if you had any sense, I think Canadians probably somewhat less get taken in by all the spin, by all the propaganda. But what's really sad is how many people, including liberal and progressive people, get taken in by the spin, by the campaigns, by the propaganda. People who you would say you absolutely should know better say, yeah, but what are they doing arresting all of these human rights activists and trade union activists and librarians? And it is amazing how many people don't do their homework. Media coverage in the United States and many other countries, and as I said, Canada is not exempted, usually contains at least a grain of truth. What grows out of that seed, how it's interpreted, how it's twisted, the conclusions then, false conclusions that are reached, often results in reporting that bears very little resemblance to what goes on. I once, in trying to, there were several major books that came out about Che Guevara during, in 97, the 30th anniversary of his death by foreigners. And they so much distorted the reality of what Che was all about that you began thinking, John Lee Anderson's book is one of them, right? John Lee Anderson's book, I had these ongoing debates for months trying to convince people this is not a good book. This is not a positive book. This is certainly not anything that Che would be very happy about. Che's widow, Aleida Guevara, Che's daughter and Che's widow consider. I tried to get Che's widow to give me an interview about the book, and she said, are you kidding? Anybody who reads that book would know it's counter-revolutionary. Well, no, not everybody who reads that book, because what they do is they mix in a whole lot of truths, half-truths, and outright lies. And unless you have the resources, you have the time, you know people, or you have some way to check it out, it's very hard. I think I told one friend that the closest analogy that I could find to those kinds of books is and especially the ones about Che, it's like walking through a field of beautiful wildflowers, being surrounded by all of these beautiful, lovely flowers, not knowing where the mines are planted, right? Because when you're reading, you usually can't. I mean, you don't have that. Internet gives us the possibility of getting into that a little bit more. You have some doubts. Your gut instinct tells you, this can't be right, but you don't have the wherewithal to figure out what is right. At least you have a way of, you know, going online, you can email somebody, you can say, hey, what's the real story behind that? And that is an important tool that I'm going to get back to. But unfortunately, the spin that most U.S. and U.S.-related corporate-controlled media put out on Cuba can't be viewed as lightly as the Pope joke. By omission and commission, due to the directives of editors, directors, publishers, producers, or sometimes, as has been pointed out in other cases, the unconscious biases on the parts of the journalists themselves or their limitations, sometimes just due to ignorance, what is reported about Cuba abroad is usually far from accurate, misleading, and in the worst cases, intentionally false. And I think other people have also talked about this before, that, you know, we can't just assume that it's a lack of resources or that even that it's always just ignorance or lack of time. That is, sometimes it is intentional. When you ask, right, how does it happen that so much of the, you know, the media can be just outright false? Warren Hinkle, who was a former editor of Ramparts magazine and used to have a column in the San Francisco Examiner, visited Cuba a number of years ago and had a series of articles in which he discovered that some information very widely published in papers across the United States at that time, and including by liberal reporters and columnists, was blatantly and provably untrue. And he raised the question, the rhetorical question in his column, whatever happened to the old journalistic rule of checking your sources? Well, he answered his own question, well, it goes right out the window when it comes to Cuba, where the other main axiom is, if it's negative, it must be true. And in the United States and increasingly Canada as well, and I know because I've also in my 20 years of reporting from Cuba about Cuba, I also worked for the Canadian Broadcasting Company as a fixer and consultant. Anything negative said about Cuba, no matter how far-fetched, is printed or broadcast, usually without question. But if there are positive things that are said about Cuba, they always have to be qualified, right? You have to say alleged, or you have to say that some communist official claimed that, or it has to be balanced by the opposing view from some, usually from some Miami Cubans or Cuban exiles. I don't want to go, because I don't think there's time. How are we doing on time? We have 5 more minutes. All right. We could go into lots of examples. The Pope's Prostitutes and Prisoners article that will be available to you afterwards has a number of typos that I didn't have a chance to catch, but I think you'll be able to get the gist anyway. Has a number of different issues, examples, everything from claiming that Christmas was celebrated in Cuba for the first time because of the Pope's visit, ignoring the fact that Christmas has always, as a religious holiday, has always been celebrated in Cuba, to the going from the U.S. version of there are no free elections in Cuba, as there were no free elections in Nicaragua. Remember when the Sandinistas got elected, they were not free elections, and when those same elections were held and the Sandinistas were voted out, they suddenly became free elections. That use of the word free, I mean, you all know the use of the word free. How, you go into a store, you go into a supermarket, and you see free, right? Or, you know, or a computer goods store, free. And then you read the fine print. Buy one, get one free, right? Or free after rebate. Or any one of these little, you know, things that somehow turn the word free around. I used to use, the Cubans loved the word free for free elections. They say, no, wait, our elections are free. They don't cost anything. Your elections, meaning the United States, are very expensive. The Senate used to be called in the United States the Millionaires Club, because you had to have $1 million in your pocket to run your campaign to get elected to the Senate. Now, if you only have $1 million, everybody would laugh you right out of there if you thought you could run a campaign. A few years back, it was $22 million that you had to have as a minimum to run for the Senate, and now it's much more than that. When Greg Palast, who wrote a great book called The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, you should get it if you haven't read it, talks about elections for sale. That's very literal in the United States. So we can play around with the term free elections. But the reason I'm raising that isn't so much the electoral question, which again you can read about in a number of very good books, including this one, which I hope you will all get if you haven't, Isaac Saney's book on Cuba, Arnold August's book, Peter Roman's book. There are a number of books available about what the actual electoral system that exists in Cuba is as compared to the version by the United States, in which it's not that they criticize the type of electoral system, they simply deny that there is one. I mean, the average American does not know that there is an electoral system in Cuba, period. So there are lots of ways that you can spin, but the main way is defining the terms. And again, I'm raising that because it's so important for us to take back control of that. We have to define the terms. We can't let them just define the terms. We need to be able to say the same as I said before. We have a huge, worldwide, very successful campaign condemning the Cuban government for arresting human rights advocates who are not human rights advocates, who couldn't care less about the fundamental human rights that we would argue for. Trade union activists who are not even workers, let alone trade union activists in the sense that we know it. Librarians who are people who have small collections of books, many of them donated by the U.S. interest section, in their homes, as compared to what they call public government libraries and what most of us know as public libraries. We have this whole array of people who are supposedly oppressed and that we are, as liberals, are supposed to be championing to be free, because we have been told over and over again these people are only in prison because of expressing their views different from the official line in Cuba. Well, aside from the fact that they are not in prison only because of expressing views, I mean, there would be millions of people. Cubans are very, very vocal about expressing their views and criticisms about everything. But aside from the fact that that's not the only reason that they are in prison, and again, this book will give you a lot more detail about why those people are imprisoned and the kinds of trials that, what laws they broke and the trials that they had, or we can answer more about that in questions and answers. But nobody ever takes that extra step back and say, all right, let's say that they were, in one way or another, ended up in prison because they were opposed to the official line. But nobody goes and says, what is that official line that they are opposed to? What is it that the Cuban government stands for that and what is it that they stand for that would make us want to champion their side? Well, the government that they are opposing is one that believes that health care, education, housing are basic human rights, that sports, that culture are basic human rights, and that it is the responsibility of a government to provide those rights equally to every single citizen of their country and to everyone else that they can reach. So these people are opposing that basic concept, and we are still allowing liberals and progressive people to be championing them because of their right to speak out, their right of free speech, their right to express themselves. And there's something missing there that we need to get at. We need to stop being manipulated by those kinds of media spins. The question is, what can we do about it, right? How can we oppose that? I think Charles Ritt, you know, sometimes the mass media, the corporate media is so massive. You can't go, you know, respond to every single radio, television, newspaper, lie and distortion. But there are things that we can do. The first, as I said, is when you're talking to other people, when you're writing, when you're talking, when you're sending email, is go back and redefine the term. Say what we mean by each of those different concepts that we're talking about. The internet helps us a lot, but we have to remember the internet is limited to people who are already looking for the answers. What we need to do is find a way to reach all those people who are not yet there. In the United States, I don't know whether it's as bad in Canada. My good feelings about Canada are that they probably wouldn't be, but in the United States, there are 11 million functional illiterates, people who simply cannot read. There are another 44 million, according to their own evaluations in surveys, that simply don't. They don't bother to read. In the United States, the average adult spends 1,450 hours a year watching television and 99 hours a year reading a book. So we have some major problems. In order to reach most people, we have to figure out some way to get on television. Michael Moore has made a great step by doing film documentaries that are reaching out to a lot of people. Alan Franken and some others have now supplemented what the Pacifica Radio Network has been doing for a long time, which is reaching people by radio. But the reality is that most people get most of their information from television news. And television news is not going to tell us the truth about the world. So I would say that the major challenge that we have, given how costly television is to figure out how are we going to make a significant impact on those airwaves. Because if we don't, we don't have a way to reach the people who wouldn't come to this kind of a conference or go to the internet sites that we would like them to read. Je vous remercie.